Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions. Happy New Year. My name is Brian, and with me all over there in the corner is my pal, Jason.
Hello, everyone.
Happy 2025, Jason.
Happy 2025. Who'd have thunk we'd
make it? Thunk we'd be in the future?
Yeah, it happened. It's here.
I'm going to the RoboJocks game this weekend. Are you?
I'm going to the Free Love Festival, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
That's coming back.
Are we going to still hang out at Carousel?
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding me? Wouldn't miss good. It.
Yeah. I got the new, the latest Soylent Green, too.
Nice.
Yeah. So, we are back. It has been a long time. We both got super busy.
Well, yeah. You know, as they say in the movies, life finds a way. I think that's...
That was a dinosaur movie, I believe.
Was a dinosaur movie, and I think what I'm trying to say is that life can get in the way or interfere.
Life can get in the way. Absolutely.
Yes, finds a way to get in the way. And
yeah.
But we've been talking about doing another app for a while, and I just thought for me, I wanted to acknowledge someone we just lost. The universe just lost, or is going back out to the universe, which is David Lynch, and someone that meant a lot to me, still means a lot to me. We've certainly dabbled in that world a few times throughout the 700 episodes we've done.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly with Dune, and I think a little bit of Twin Peaks, and just some quirkiness, or talking about, you know, television.
Well, it's definitely in our toolbox.
Yeah.
I mean, I should confess that I am not a giant fan of the man, of his oeuvre. I don't hate it, but I'm certainly aware of him, and I've checked out a lot of his films, and I can definitely converse on the subject.
Yeah, it's. I figured it was enough that you would be familiar enough with him.
Well, I got to tell you, and it's a buddy of mine who's actually in the Pod Stallions group, my friend Brian, who was a big influence, you know, us sharing movies. But he's a huge Lynch fan. And while I never shared his appreciation, I completely understood what he got out of it.
Well, it's interesting because in the last week, you know, week and whatever it's been since he passed, and I knew, you know, it was coming, and he was 79, just turned.
Was he not a heavy smoker?
Heavy smoker. I mean, when I got to meet him at Amoeba, he was firing up heaters left and right. I mean, he was smoking in the record store.
He was a Rod Serling.
He really was. For a long time, you know, from his teen years, I think. So the emphysema, announcement got made, I think, in 2021, maybe, or so. See, my thinking was, too, that being that of that ilk that we were growing up,
mm-hmm.
and exploring, and the video store, and
reading
about things, like, you couldn't not have known who David Lynch was. Like, even if it wasn't your thing, or you didn't see him or whatever, you couldn't not know the impact that he was having and what he was doing. And for me,
because Eraserhead was always in the newspaper when I was
it was like a midnight thing. On the U of M campus.
Yeah.
Like on a Friday or Saturday night, I remember seeing the picture. My brother used to have those calendars, and I'd see the photo, and I was whatever age it was to kind of know, okay, I think that's like a weird movie. I think that's sort of like there's a weird batch of things. This is like right after The Elephant Man. So I saw The Elephant Man in the theater.
Did you really?
With my mother.
Okay.
And I can't remember if she wanted to see it and we went, or if I asked to see it. I don't remember, but it's strange that I would have seen that film in the theater, not really knowing what it was about.
Well, also, I wanted to talk about that, but, you know, we're not going to go linear, but the marketing for that film was almost as if it was a horror movie shown at midnight. It was that black and white photo. And I've often thought that was a wonderful discordance, but also a callback to what the film was about, where it's like it's this, you know, sideshow freak. But then what the film is really about is he's a human being.
Well, it's and, also, but how well it reflects the Universal Monsters.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The look of it, but also the
pathos.
They're all the pathos, and they're misunderstood. They're not monsters. They're just, this is their thing, man, or whatever.
Yeah, no, but I always thought the marketing was like brilliant in that regard, because you went to see like a scary movie. And you're going to see one that would actually move you to tears.
I think I might have thought it was something weird or scary or something. I don't remember.
I assumed he looked like an elephant because, as we know, wasn't smart.
Literal. Yeah. The poster, it wasn't, I remember it being not just a black and white photo, but kind of a
gritty,
like a weathered black and white image.
Yeah. There's like, there's cross hatching in there.
Yes. There's cross hatching in it. And so it's very minimalist, and you've got that logo, you know, with the, it almost looks like bones kind of. But you know, I'm a kid in the theater with this, and just, I don't know what I'm watching. I mean, I know what the beats are. I know why I'm feeling the things I'm feeling, but as it starts, I really don't know what I'm in for here.
Yeah. That was sort of our childhood. There was no guardrails.
Well, that's the other thing. It's not like, I was talking to my buddy the other night, and he said, we were talking about, you know, babysitters, or nights we had hot babysitters or whatever we're thinking being kids. And he remembered one time when his parents went into the city, they went into Boston for date night on a Saturday night, and they went to see The Deer Hunter in 1978, and I nearly dropped the phone. I was like, what? Did they have any idea what that movie was or what it was about? And the thing is, they might have said, I've heard good things, you know, it's got some good, you know, I think it's up for some awards or something or whatever, you know, and God knows what they thought when they got to the theater. But that's the thing. It's like, it's not like you knew a movie inside and out and a ton of details before. You know, you saw maybe a trailer.
I was dragged to the drive-in to see Car Wash.
See? Child. Lucky kid.
I was a lucky boy, although I was lied to and told there would be cartoons after. And then when I wasn't asleep at the end, my dad said no cartoons and just drove home.
Well, he tried. Yeah. He tried. Maybe he genuinely thought. You never know.
No, I'm pretty sure it was grade A bullshit.
But it was so that was my first sort of experience, and I knew who he was then. And so by the time I came around to Dune, I mean, I don't know if I'd seen a photo of him or really knew who he was, but I certainly knew the name. And then when Dune came around, I was familiar with Dune because of my mother, who read the books. I had never read the books at that point. And I just knew that it was the same guy. That's all I kind of knew. And we all know how
you would have actually picked up on the style, eh?
I started to be that kid that kind of recognized a name, like a producer name, or the Sal Kinds, or just a director's name or whatever. I did kind of pick those things up, and I don't know why. Same thing with actors' faces. I could just see a face in something, like the legend we just lost, whose name I can't think of, but the guy who was in the hockey player in Strange Brew, who was also in Star Wars.
I
just lost him.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing Strange Brew going, that guy was in Star Wars. You know, he's in this, you know, scene. So just stuff like that started to happen at a certain age, and I would get familiar with things. But Dune was definitely more for Dune, because I thought, you know, this is just a legendary thing I've heard so much about, and it's going to be the greatest thing ever, and it's going to be huge, and all the things we've discussed. And the thing about Lynch, and I want to get back to something you were saying earlier about, you know, I've been revisiting a lot of his stuff, and I realize, and I think I've said this before probably, you know, I can go on about the brilliance and the genius on display and the artistry, but it's not like I put on Blue Velvet once a year on a Saturday night, or Lost Highway, or Mulholland Drive. These are heavy movies, man, with really heavy.
Yeah.
And so my go-to for him has always been Dune and Twin Peaks. Those are my, I love,
I think
it all.
They're his most commercially approachable and repeatable films. You're right. Because even The Elephant Man and Eraserhead is almost designed to make you uncomfortable.
Well, now that, now when did you remember seeing that for the first time?
I was much older. I think what, actually the first David Lynch thing I ever saw was Dune in the theater.
Oh, what? Oh, I keep forgetting that you saw that in the theater.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater with my frenemy, who was very condescending to me, you know, like, you won't understand this. And so it really did frame my opinion of Dune negatively, you know, and I've said that before, but I do kind of think it's not a film. I don't think the film is his failing. I think he, you know, somebody optioned a book series and hoped they could make Star Wars out of it. And it's not Star Wars.
No.
And I think Lynch understood what it was, which was this ugly future of oligarchies and, you know, it's houses warring against each other. It's unpleasant. It's dreary. And
I'm with you.
I think it's backlit by the bizarre angle that, like, they were selling merchandise, you know, like action figures. And you've got movies like Krull that, you know, are just designed for action figures getting nothing. But there literally is a figure in that line that has a cat. And that's the cat that another character has to drink the milk of. And it's like, this is insane. Like,
one of them. The most outrageous accessories in the history of action figures. It's funny. I was over at Matt Weinholtz about a week ago, and he loves Dune. I don't think I knew that he dug it as much as he does, but he had all the big sand crawler thing and all the figures loose. The cardboard part of the box for the sand crawler thing or sand, whatever it's called, the big deluxe.
Did he have the large genitalia?
No. Here's the thing. He wants my sandworm.
We got to have indoor thoughts here, sir.
I've got one, friend, and he wants my sandworm, and he's trying to build a little treasure package, a little pile of Godzilla things and different odds and ends that he's going to make into a big, like a grade school trade. Like, okay, I'll give you all this for the sandworm kind of thing. But we were talking about.
Don't you give that up.
We're talking about the Sting accessory, the Fade character. That has got to be, in the history of action figure accessories, that's got to be the most insane thing ever given to a toy. It's a cat. The sculpture is a little cat with a mouse tied to its side.
Yeah.
And then the other character who's not made a figure of, Thufir Howitt, has to milk the cat to get the antidote to the poison that's been put into his system. The thing you were saying about the movie itself and his work and like how he, you know, nobody can say he didn't give it his all. I mean, that they were down there.
I honestly think he got... I think he got it.
I do too.
I feel like it's like square peg round hole. They wanted a Star Wars.
Well, and also,
and he delivered Dune.
It's a, put it this way. If I don't know, Peter Hyams, let's say, or someone of a certain ilk were given Dune in 1982, 83 to make a big thing in 84, it would have looked very, very, very different. The thing that I think was kind of its undoing, there's many things that were its undoing, but part of it too was, and it doesn't get commented on enough, and certainly not in all the accolades I've seen, all the articles I've read in the last, you know, week or so, and the best of lists and all the things, Dune barely gets a mention. And the thing is, to me, it's as much a David Lynch movie as anything else he did, even though it's a Frank Herbert book, and he adapted it. That is a David Lynch movie. That movie's insane. There's a lot of just crazy shit in there.
Yeah, he added a lot of the ugliness, if I recall correctly.
He absolutely did.
Because isn't it like, I was talking to somebody about it, or maybe it was you guys. Who else will I talk to Dune about? The eyebrows on the certain people was added by David Lynch. And
yeah, Thufir had the, yeah. Well, there's in the book, I think they have the Mentats have, I think, a slight stain to the lips because they ingest the spice or something like that. That helps. They're mathematicians because computers are outlawed in this world because there was
whatever. Because computers enslaved people or something. Yes. Yeah.
And so they've got these like blue, you know, chapped kind of weird stained lips and the eyebrows and, you know, the bad skin on the Baron. I mean, these things aren't in the book, but the you know, there's it really pushes the envelope with the Baron. Like molesting.
Yeah, he's disgusting.
And molesting the young guy and pulling out his heart plug. And you clearly think, oh, I think he's into kids or something.
I think Herbert wrote that, though.
And Herbert wrote that. And he got it in the freaking movie. And I bet it, you know, his original cut, I think, was like 4 hours or longer. And they made him cut it down to what it was. And it always
have you ever seen like the true Lynch cut of Dune? Does that exist?
There's a book that came out last year that's exhaustive about the making of the film. And I don't think anybody's really seen it. I think maybe some of the studio people have, but it doesn't seem to exist. But the Alan Smithy version, the TV version that has extra footage and a bunch of paintings that give you a prologue of what happened to humanity and so on and so forth, that exists on DVD. I have it on a Japanese edition kind of thing. It's like a longer cut with a bunch of scenes that weren't in the theatrical cut. That's kind of the best you get. And there's some deleted stuff on there too. But I mean, it was exhaustive.
Do you like, in terms of Dune, do you like the remakes or do you still lean towards Lynch?
I love the remakes. I love Villeneuve. I love his work from Sicario. From Prisoners forward, really. And he's just one of those guys I think is just going to get better and better. And he knows his way around fantasy or science fiction or whatever. I love those films. They're great.
But does it top Lynch for you?
Well, that's the thing. It's like if you're talking about accessibility and narrative to someone that has no idea what the story is, then I would say sit yourself down in front of the two-parter, the Villeneuve one.
Yeah.
And, you know, but for sheer grandeur and the look and the costumes and the sets and the imagination and the design of the weapons, and I got to give it to Lynch because it just, there's more to chew on screen. And this is, again, my opinion, but we sat through a lot of fantasy and sci-fi, and we have since, you know, we were kids. It's very, very tough to pull off actually feeling like you're seeing something you haven't seen before.
I
think Flash Gordon is right up there because no one's ever tried to get near it again. It is a one-off. It is an absolute one-off. Maybe Barbarella in a small way, but not even in the same league. And I got to say Dune. I mean, nothing looks like Dune. It really was, they put a shit ton of money and effort into it. But you know, it crippled him. I mean, I think it made him sick for a long time, and they just tore the thing apart. It didn't make money. But when he made the deal with De Laurentiis, after turning down Return of the Jedi, I mean, wonder what that
I would love to see. Like I've heard that story, which always amuses me, and it's one of the things I always wanted to say was that Lynch is not one of my favorite filmmakers, but if he was speaking in my town, I would go. I would be in the front row because I do like him as a person.
He's something. He really
is quirky. He's a quirky fellow, and he's honest.
He's the real deal. There's no.
Yeah, bullshit. I think when you go to see someone like that, you're basically going to see someone who sees the world differently than you.
Yeah.
And I would rather that than someone who shared my opinion.
And I think he felt he was going to have more freedom doing Dune and be left on his own, which for the most part he was, I think.
Yeah, and that's why I don't fault him for that. I don't think De Laurentiis understood what he had.
No.
And They gave an what I would consider an auteur
free
reign to take someone else's material, and I think he did it justice from what I've read of Dune,
but it is crazy to think, if you're a studio executive at that time, or De Laurentiis or whoever, all you really have to go on are those two films. You want to make this commercial sci-fi blockbuster that's going to lead to five more movies and, you know, gum cards and cereals and everything. Is that the guy? That the guy you're going
to like, I understood why Mel Brooks wanted him for The Elephant Man.
Yes.
Because he had seen Basket Case, and Basket Case is unpleasant.
You mean Eraserhead?
Oh, sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. I always get those two because they're both midnight movies.
It's Eraserhead's very unpleasant. It's hard.
I always get those two movies mixed up because of that. Eraserhead's very unpleasant. It's very strange.
Yes.
And it's definitely art house, to the point where, like, I agree with it. It should be played at art house, and I think it played for decades at art houses before VHS.
Long time.
And I see why.
Yeah, I think it was on posters and T-shirts before people even saw it.
Yeah. They had a picture of Jack Nance, who, I gotta point out, like, one of the most iconic faces of the 80s. And the guy got stabbed at a donut shop.
So weird. You know, he brings this, I'm going to say this, a strangeness. To everything he ever did.
Even he isn't Dune. Has
in The Blob, you know, the small doctor part he has in that. He's just an oddball. He's in Dune just turning up this machine, this like steam machine or noise machine or something that's kind of getting the Baron off or whatever. It's he doesn't really even, I don't think he even says anything.
And of course, I think he's more of an extra in that, more than anything.
Yeah. And he's in Blue Velvet and he's in Twin Peaks, and he was pretty loyal to a lot of actors that kind of made up a troupe. But one of the things I find fascinating about that whole Dune and just the madness surrounding it, according to Kyle MacLachlan, he met him once and Lynch like took one look at him and was like, that's the guy. That's the guy I want. And so you're hanging your franchise and this big movie on this guy who's not done anything. And he acquits himself quite well in that movie for a 22 or 23, whatever he was. He does a great job, and he's in there with heavyweights in every scene. Jürgen Prochnow and, you know, Max von Sydow,
like Patrick Stewart is
Patrick Stewart.
I mean, that guy's that's a classically trained actor, you know.
Yeah, and he's you know, he's the heroic lead kind of thing. But this thing fails. Doesn't make any money and gets really critically lambasted. But the deal he made with De Laurentiis was, okay, I'll do your movie, but you got to produce two other movies that I want to do.
For 75 cents each.
For 50 cents and a Snickers.
Yeah.
Bob's Big Boy. And the first one was Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And any other director, I would imagine, would want to keep as far away from anything to do with what was just considered a disaster as they could. But he turns right around and recasts MacLachlan again as the lead in Blue Velvet. I think that's one of the ballsiest moves by a director ever, to go, no, I'm doing what I want to do. I don't care about the last. This is who I want, and I know it. And he was right. He bet on MacLachlan, and, you know, it's been a 40-year career for the guy. He got the right guy, you know. But I find that extraordinary that he didn't flinch thinking of casting him again when that thing did not go well. And they were, you know, best of friends for 40 years.
Have you heard of Blue Peanuts?
Blue Peanuts?
Yeah, there was when I used to go down to the annex, there was Suspect Video. And one of the clerks there was a guy by the name of Todd. And he had actually done festivals with short films he made, you know, cinching the dialogue from cartoons to famous movies. And he had done Apocalypse Poo and Blue Peanuts was his other thing, where it was just basically the dialogue of Blue Velvet overlaid on the Peanuts. I think Dennis Hopper's character Frank Morgan there was Snoopy.
I mean, this is ringing a bell. First of all, I might have seen it on VHS, like a VHS burn in the 90s or something. This is totally ringing a bell. I watched it the other night, three, four nights ago, and I haven't seen Blue Velvet in probably over a decade, I'd say. Maybe longer, you know. And what's interesting about some of his stuff, and again, I'm freely admitting that I can sit like District 9. I could sit through District 9 and go, great movie. I never need to see it again. I cannot watch that movie again. Well done, you know.
Smart. Yeah, that's it's like you've it's seen it. Yeah, it's heartbreaking and
it's too much. And I
it's a shame that like Neil Blomkamp never made another film like that, you know?
No. And he may still, but he never.
Really I hope he has it in him. Yeah.
For those heights. But I'm watching it and I'm instantly in the theater in 1986 watching this film. And what's the reason I don't need to revisit those movies that much is they're seared into my brain.
Yeah, they and left a scar.
They left a freaking scar. And there are things in Blue Velvet. There are two moments that. To this day, I remember the feeling I had in the theater of first is Dean Stockwell singing In Dreams, the Orbison tune with the light on his, you know, as a microphone. I'm sitting there going, what am I watching? What the fuck is going on? And the other scene is Isabella Rossellini, you know, naked on the lawn, battered and bruised, walking in the background towards McLaughlin. This very domestic scene at night and with these teenagers arguing with their cars. It just was this bit of you know, trauma I'd never seen in a film. And it really shook me up. Really shook me up. And Hopper, of course, is just, you know, he's on fire.
Remember that when they parodied Hopper's character on SNL?
What's That Smell?
What's That Smell? That was Frank bizarre. Booth. Yeah. That's a scary hunker you got there, Chet.
I mean, it was, you know, he was really something in that movie. I hadn't seen it in a long time. And it's like, whoa. And Rossellini's incredible. And but there's bits I kind of have to fast forward through. I'm going, okay, this is getting really uncomfortable.
Well, I've probably said this to you before, but my friend and I in the 2000s used to have a joke. If you go into someone's house and they have a copy of Requiem for a Dream on the shelf, you're like, hey, do you watch that often?
Hey, here's an idea. Let's order a pizza and put on Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, it's like, fun. You know, like, sorry, I saw it once.
I don't. And Blue Velvet is one of those. It's a film that this is going to sound negative. I don't mean it to, but it's disparate parts mean more to me than the thing from end to end. I think it's a fantastic film. I did when it came out. It is. I think it is all that people kind of say that it is. But for me, it's moments that I go to, like a 2 minute thing or a minute thing or that Dean Stockwell scene is just, it still gives me the chills. But they're not easy. It's not easy to sit through. And it's kind of remarkable that it was a hit. You know, it was a low budget film, but it made a good chunk of money and he was up for Best Director, the Academy Awards. He was up for Best Director and he was up for Best Director for Elephant Man too, which is incredible. Hopper was up for Best Supporting Actor for Hoosiers. And I remember the Entertainment Tonight or somebody had a camera on him live when they were making the announcement or something. And they said, Dennis Hopper for Hoosiers. And he kind of went, Hoosiers?
Yeah.
Like, what?
I was in Hoosiers?
Yeah. I don't remember. They were too scared to nominate him for Blue Velvet. because he's so terrifying in that movie. And it's, you know, the other thing that he occasionally would get criticized for, and I think it's misguided, is the violence and the treatment of women in a lot of his stuff. But he is showing the evil that men do. He's got strong female characters in most of his stuff. And he spent a career examining the darkness of men and
violence. Yeah, I always thought he was like putting a mirror up to society in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. Absolutely. And it's uncomfortable, and it's certainly, I'm rewatching The Return, Twin Peaks The Return, you know, 18 hours, but I don't care, and I'm rewatching it again, and it's just loaded with stuff and a darkness to it. But so, you know, I saw it once. I saw Blue Velvet once in the theater. I'm sure I'm guessing you saw it on VHS at some point when it came out.
Yeah, I have seen it. It really, because of the subject matter, is not a favorite of mine.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd be worried if it was,
frankly. Yeah, no, I know that, but you know, a little bit of my history, and that there's certain subjects that I just don't enjoy being seen on screen, but it is, you know, I respect it. I, like I said, I respect a lot of his work. Some of it's not for me. I will say this, and this might be the part. I have very good friends, and I've explained this to you before. Like, I get why they like Lynch,
mm-hmm.
but I have been in the room with the guy who uses it like a weapon. I just want to bring this up because it was one of those things that made me not even want to watch Lynch for a long time or even talk about it. Was I think it was a party I went to, and pretty sure I walked in with this guy's ex-girlfriend. So that immediately made a target of me, but talking about film, and I said, I really like Lynch. And he kind of did this whole like, well, that's because you don't get it. Mm. And I was like, dude, like, it's just the weirdest hill to use.
I know what you mean. I've been very lucky, I think. You've had a lot of experiences like this with these kinds of guys that seem to want to lord a thing or pee in the snow.
But this was just basically like, I wasn't like, that's crap. I was like, yeah. Because like I said to you, I have good friends who like love David Lynch, and I get why. Like, it's not that I'm like, yeah. But things cannot be for
you don't
me.
You don't have to explain to anyone.
But what I'm trying to say is that this guy was trying to basically use it as like, oh, you're too stupid to
see
his brilliance.
It could have been Kubrick. It could have been anything. Whatever might have said that wasn't in his wheelhouse, you would have gotten that, you know, the response. And that's just, you know, we know who that individual is. I've been very lucky. I've had thousands of conversations about film and music and all kinds of things. I rarely run into those know-it-all kind of, you know, weaponized people.
Have you ever seen David Lynch's... What's that?
Well, I'll say, and what you do when a particular subject comes up, unless someone's being gross or something, but if someone says, oh, you know, I didn't really like the thing. The next logical thing is to either go, oh, okay, that's cool, yeah. What did you like that you saw last year or whatever? Or to go, really, you didn't? Okay, was there something specific about it? And have a conversation. And I'm not going to try to change your mind, but it at least sparks a curiosity in me to go, oh yeah, I get why you wouldn't. You know, David Lynch is the kind of thing like With Nell and I, the movie With Nell and I. I've recommended it to loads of people. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And I've had as many that have come back loving it as have come back and said, I don't get it. I could barely get through it kind of thing. And you don't go, really? You couldn't get, well, what's wrong with you? You go, yeah, I get it. I get, that makes sense. I thought you might, but if you don't, totally makes sense.
I want to tell you, because you brought up With Nell and I have to talk about my experience seeing it. One of my roommates was a film student, and he would always, you know, when we went to rent movies, we'd rent the dumb stuff, and then he'd always pick one, and it was always the one I remember. And we watched with Neil and I, you know, eight guys hungover, smoking cigarettes, watching this movie. And I remember loving it. But the thing that made me laugh is I think the beginning of it, they're just showing a big greasy, like grill at the start, aren't they?
Yep. He's at the grill and trying to get coffee.
And they put two eggs on it and it floats in the grease. And I had a English roommate. It just went,
Yeah. Well, there's a bit where they make an egg sandwich, put the egg in between two pieces of toast. And then this, you know, kind of, you barely see her face, you know, takes a bite into it and it kind of, you know, goes out the end of the. And of course he's, you know, he's coming down off a, you know, a bender. And so he's getting watching it and everything, but if somebody came back to me and said, I didn't you know, like, you go, okay, yeah, but you know, I get that. Now, you know, there's some things you can come back and go, hated it, where I do go, really? I've never heard a strong version.
Hate is a really weird one,
you know, for the Muppet movie, really. Like,
it wasn't, you know, believable.
Yeah, that's when I'll lock horns and go, what the fuck? Come on. Sorry. What? You know, because that's just like you're being a contrarian or whatever. I don't know. But Lynch, you know, I think it was a mini Tarantino. Tarantino comes along and you get a lot of imitators. He opens a door with what he's doing, the very specificity of what he's doing that only he can really do by this point. And he's on a roll, you know, with
True Romance. Except I would say Tarantino was more commercially successful than.
No, he was. But what I'm saying is an impact is made and you start to get, you get imitators. Yeah. You get people trying to be Lynchian or Tarantino-esque or whatever. And so it doesn't create the movement that Tarantino did in the early 90s, where you get a lot of wannabes and, you know,
things to do in Denver when you're dead is a classic.
Eight heads in a duffel bag or whatever. You know, these things that are, they're, oh, quirky title. It's gonna wonder what that, you know, Killing Zoe, which what's his name did? Roger Avery. It's fucking horrible.
How did that guy co-write Pulp Fiction?
He co-wrote a story, I think, in there. I think he got the Oscar. But you know, Lynch is a I think you have to appreciate the strangeness of it working the way that it did. The Elephant Man was an Oscar nominated film. I mean, that is a heavy subject. That is a strange film to make, and it's a heavy subject. Blue Velvet, you know, the next one's a disaster. Blue Velvet is a tough view for most people. But it's critically lauded. I think it might have won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. I forget.
It was definitely something that put him on the map. Like, put him again on the map. Yeah.
And then the next thing he does is a pilot for ABC. CBS. For a network television pilot co-written by David Lynch. It was just unthinkable that could happen. I don't think anybody knew what to expect, but again, I recognize the name. I know who this guy is. I see the commercials. I'm there for the pilot, and it, you know, blows my mind. I mean, it to this day, you can go back and watch that, even the first few episodes, and go, there's never been anything on network television like it. To this day, they're spawned a lot of imitators. But again, it's something that, For a million reasons, shouldn't have found an audience. It shouldn't have worked, but it did, and it became a mini phenomenon for a short time.
We're talking about Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks was that summer was the summer of Twin Peaks. Who Killed Laura Palmer? T-shirts and the books that came.
I didn't have cable that summer, so I had no idea.
You had no TV?
It
was a net, so that you didn't have the network, like it wasn't on it. Where did it air there? Did it air there?
Well, I think it aired on like ABC, and I remember it in college because somebody came up to my dorm room and said, you guys watching Twin Peaks? And we were watching The Simpsons.
And, okay, so
but I think like after that, like I don't know when the show premiered or ended, but
it was it premiered in 1990, I want to say
in like April or something.
It might have been. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't remember, but I think I was out of the dorm room by the time it finished.
Okay. Because it certainly hit around the world. It hit big in Japan, in the UK, but in America certainly it became what, you know,
I don't want to pretend like I wasn't aware of it.
But I think everywhere. Like as the phenomenon went, if you were in the thick of it like I was, and you know, week to week, it did. It might have even I could be wrong about this, but the term, you know, water cooler conversation, or you know, water cooler people at work going, hey, did you see the thing? I don't know if it started with Twin Peaks, if that term kind of started, but it became this thing that people were talking about, and people found each other, and then they'd have viewing parties and things like that, and started fan clubs and so on. And then the network orders more episodes for the fall, but they start pushing to solve the mystery, to solve the murder. I mean, they, Frost and Lynch knew where they were going, but Lynch kept saying, why? Just you got the golden goose here, laying golden eggs. Just let it go on for a while. We don't have to rush to get to this thing. Let's let it breathe.
But yeah, and that's funny. And that's the opposite of Lost.
Yep. 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 They knew exactly where they were going, but they wanted to milk it and bring more characters in and more mystery and, you know, answer questions, but keep some mysteries going. And also with his stuff, and I should say this across all of his stuff, you don't get all the answers, and he won't answer. You know, if there's a
provocative filmmaker.
Yeah, he's just kind of going, well, what do you think it means? Yeah. You know, I have a feeling, and he's coming at it from his viewpoint, his you know, influence of Waking Dreams and, you know, donut holes and to the Tibetan
Woody Woodpecker dolls.
Yeah, he finds the muse and the inspiration where it is. And so sometimes he doesn't even know the answer, but that's not the point. The journey is part of the point. You get a lot of answers, but you don't get all of them. And I remember, you remember that Jonathan Ross, what was it called? The
Incredibly Strange Film Show.
Yes. Show. And he's got a Lynch episode, and it's not long after Blue Velvet comes out. And he corners him at the end about that freaking bird on the windowsill at the end of Blue Velvet that is clearly animatronic. It's like a robin, and it's got like a cockroach in its mouth. And, you know, McLaughlin and Laura Dern and the mom and the grandma, they're all in the kitchen and the aunt, and they're all going, oh, look, it's a robin. The robins. I mean, it's totally Leave It to Beaver moment. Like they're totally being in a 50s, you know, sitcom kind of thing or show.
Yeah.
But when Ross asked him about the robin, he goes, come on, why did you, it was animatronic, right? And it's like, no, it was a real, that was a real robin up there. It was a real, he still wouldn't answer if it was a real bird or not. It's clearly not.
Yeah, but that I think that just appeals to his whole grotesquery of the 1950s. I kind of dig that.
Yeah, it's very, I've never felt like it was an act in any way. I felt like he was just.
No, his sincerity for me was the same. I never doubted that he was like Marilyn Mansoning this a little bit.
Nope.
You know?
Yep, never. He just, he was exactly what, you know, that great line from Mel Brooks. When Mel Brooks met him the first time, he said, it was like Jimmy Stewart from Mars.
Yeah.
And that's the perfect description. I mean, and I think that's, and so. He can show you the Blue Velvet song playing with a fire truck going by and a fireman waving and the flowers and the robins singing and so on. And then the grotesque stuff under the surface. It's a weird dichotomy. And he does it all through Twin Peaks. you know, as far as he could take it on a network show. So they pushed him to do the second, he did the second season, and they pushed for an answer. And when they finally reveal who the killer is, they got it, you know, they open up more mysteries and keep it going. But by that point, he's getting kind of irritated with how they're treating it. He goes off to do Wild at Heart with Nicolas Cage.
And yeah, which is something I'd like to discuss because I can see that in the theater as well.
All right.
And I'm not sure why I did. but it, I do kind of, this is brought, where I've discovered Crispin Glover.
Because
a friend of mine had a huge fascination with Crispin Glover. Same friend who was into Lynch, and we listened to his record once on a road trip. And I love Crispin Glover's character in this because he's like afraid of plastic gloves. And it's just like, it's the kind of nonsense that you take with you for the rest of your life. You
know? Yeah, isn't that saying something, that these little moments where you just go,
oh yeah, no. This is what I got my friend Brian being involved in this, is that he loved those weird little moments, those absurd little interstitials. And I got that, you know, like I understand why you would. It's comedic, it's strange.
He liked a lot of slap. He'd talk about slapstick.
Yeah.
And at one point he described it as, you know, if you're sitting somewhere and you saw someone run against a wall and kind of bash their head against it and then just keep doing it, you'd be horrified, but you might start to laugh and think, what am I watching here? What is this? Absurd? So it's a strange way to kind of see the world, but that's about, I think Wild at Heart is kind of where, and Twin Peaks certainly, where more of the humor of Lynch starts to come in, and the bits of absurdity and the character things like that, that are kind of laugh out loud moments of silliness, or like, what is that? There's a moment in Wild at Heart. I heard a great story from Dennis Hopper about Blue Velvet, which totally, I like, twisted my melon. He got the script, and when he accepted it, now they're filming, whatever, and it's coming time for the breathing apparatus, you know, sucking in the thing. And and in the script, it just kind of was what it was. And then he talks to Lynch on the set, and the thing that's been brought to the set is helium. So he's gonna be breathing. This is a true story. He's gonna be breathing in helium. And Frank Booth's voice would have sounded like Mickey Mouse for all of that dialogue. And Dennis Hopper goes, really? And Lynch goes, yeah, that's kind of what I, and Hopper goes, well, I was thinking it was something like, you know, amyl nitrate or like a weird kind of, and Lynch is like, well, I don't know what that is. What is that? You know, like, well, David, I'll tell you what, I'll do it the way I think. If it was something else, well, let's just do it. And if you really don't like it, we can add in the voice later. We can do something. And of course, go do it. Here, go on here. And, you know, we got what we got. It didn't happen. Yeah. But it was almost helium. There's a moment in Wild at Heart where Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern are sitting at a bar, and it's like jazz music being played or swing music in the background. And the great actor Freddie Jones, the guy who played Thufir in Dune, comes up to the bar, and he just goes, yeah. He kind of looks at them, and he looks back at the band and goes, yeah. And this Mickey Mouse voice comes out of him, and he says, yeah, like to the band. And then he kind of looks at them and says something about pigeons spread disease. You must know this. But it's like a Mickey Mouse voice. And it's so fucking weird in this moment. And they're both looking at him like, okay, you know, you're thinking, are they hearing the voice? Does he talk? And I found out years later that for some reason, that piece of footage, when Lynch viewed it the first time, was sped up. The audio was sped up somehow. And so Freddie Jones' voice sounded like that. And he thought it was so funny that he just kept it in the film. So it's kind of like he got the Frank Booth thing he wanted with helium in this little moment. But it's just a bizarre clip. You can find just the clip on YouTube. And it's like, what? What? It just, it, there's, you don't get any answers. But it's a great journey, kind of.
Well, speaking of that, with Wild at Heart, you know, Nicolas Cage did a like a weird voice for Peggy Sue Got Married.
Like he that. Certainly did.
Yeah, so that maybe that's him. What attracted him to Lynch.
I think they might have wanted to fire him.
Yeah, because he sounds like Pokey from the Gumby comics.
Yeah, I remember seeing that the first time going, what is he doing?
Yeah.
Like, people must have been really scared of what he was doing, in that movie, but it seemed to have worked. He seemed to have kind of pulled it off. But that's another one that's very violent, very strange. It's not an original work of Lynch's. It's based on a book, which actually Alex de la Iglesia, I believe his name is, who did some horror films. He did a film called Perdita Durango with Javier Bardem and not Penelope Cruz. I forget who the female lead is, but it's basically the same two characters from Wild at Heart, you know, going on a killing and crime spree kind of. Many, many years later, but I think there's a series of books those two characters are in. So he's doing that, and then he comes back to finish Twin Peaks because the ratings start to go down. It's a different show now. He's not as involved. It's getting more wacky. And they certainly wanted to go on, but it was just a moment in time and didn't get to. And then the work becomes much more sparse as time goes on. He does these weird things.
He did that Twin Peaks movie.
Well, that's the other. That's another. That's when the nails start to get pounded into the coffin. Now they've been very kind to him with Twin Peaks. He's been critically lauded and toasted and everything. Talk of the Town, Blue Velvet, etc. Now they're coming to get him because that movie came out and people just hated it. The critics hated it.
Yeah. And wasn't it like dumped in like January?
Yeah. And he. For some reason, David Frost wasn't involved with it. It's still considered canon in the story. It's the few days before Laura Dern's murder, so it's a bit of a prequel, I guess. And it's got stuff in it that is in the return, the 18-hour return that was in 2017. So it's all part of the same soup, you know, kind of. But it's another movie that's a tough swallow, you know. It's kind of very violent, very Cheryl Lee, who played Laura Dern, is incredible in it. What the things that she has to go through, but it's not something you want to spin on a Friday night. You don't. It's really, and so that was like, okay, this is the end of Twin Peaks. Basically, he wanted to do this, and that's it, and it's done. McLaughlin's barely in it. David Bowie is in it as a character called Philip Jeffries, which comes into play in The Return. But it doesn't really do anything. And it kind of says, okay, it's over kind of. And then we get Lost Highway. I think he does a show. He did what was going to be this is weird. You'll appreciate this. He was an anthology show that happened on HBO called, oh shit, what's it called? Room 503, I think it's, no.
Oh, Hotel, I remember the sound of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Hotel Room is what it's called.
Okay.
They only shot three episodes, and they ran them twice, I think, on HBO, and it never went to full series. And it's it's okay. It's up on, you can find it on YouTube, and it's not great, but you get Freddie Jones and Glenn Headley and Harry Dean Stanton and Deborah Unger and, you know, lots of faces you'll recognize in there. Crispin Glover's in one of them too, but they don't do anything. He does a sitcom that might have been on ABC called On the Air.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
I think they shot 8 episodes and only aired 6, maybe.
3.
You know, so the 3. Okay. So the shine is wearing off. And I watched that, but then it just kind of did. I went, where is this? Is that all we're going to? And then he does Lost Highway, which I forget who the guy's author, the name of the book was, but, and that's a head.
I bought that soundtrack.
That's a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
That's a great soundtrack. Yeah, I guess we should mention that too. His love of music, his love of sound design and music. And he rarely sat still. He was always working on, you know, whether it was physical art, painting, or, you know, music or whatever, but he really had an ear, you know, to work with Bowie and Trent Reznor and I can't think of her name now. The Julie Cruz, who had some stuff in Twin Peaks. I mean, he really was a bit of a Renaissance man with that stuff. But did you see that in the theater, or did you see that on VHS?
No, I've actually never seen that, because friends of mine who were Lynch fans did not like it.
I see.
And I was like, well, then I'm staying far, or should I like it? You know.
I rewatched it in the last week and a half or so. I haven't seen it in a long, long time. You know, Bill Pullman, Patricia Arquette,
Beretta. Robert Lester,
Beretta.
In kabuki makeup.
The time. I mean, that scene, if you've never seen that scene at the party.
Where he says, I told you I'd be here, or whatever, and he phones his own thing.
Call me. Where did we meet? He says, well, at your house. Don't you remember? You know? And then he says something like, I'm there right now. Call me. And then he hands him the phone and he dials his number and he answers the phone. And then when he's done with the conversation, he goes, give the phone back to me. And he hands the phone back to Robert Blake, like, what the f-? I mean, it's an unsettling scene.
Yeah.
Lynch bordered on horror. That's what I wanted to bring up too. Like, so, and again, with this rewatch of some of this stuff and the 18 part return, there's a chill, there's an uncomfortable, there's just a chill down the spine in a lot of stuff that he did, in a lot of moments and scenes that are just, you know, I guess you just say are Lynchian, or just no one else would do that or could do it quite that way. It's not Carpenter, it's not Hitchcock, it's not, he's doing something else, but it's the same kind of effect. He's making you, you know, he's giving you something in the pit of your stomach, kind of. And it could just be in a line of dialogue that kind of twists your head a bit, or that Blake moment or whatever. So it's a good movie. It's got a great soundtrack, and but it's weird. I mean, it's a weird movie, not for all tastes. And then we get was it Mulholland Drive after that? I think so.
Yeah, like it's scattershot.
Yeah, that was going to be a pilot. That was going to be a TV series, I believe, for ABC. So when you see that movie, you realize that the first half is the pilot, and then he kind of wrapped it up with the remainder. And they made it something different, something else. They made it into a standalone movie. But I think it was meant to be a TV series. And Robert Forster was in it. And oddly enough, he was originally cast as the sheriff in Twin Peaks in 1990, but had some other prior commitment and couldn't do it. Uh-huh. So when the return came back in 2017, and he got everybody back for this thing, whether it's one scene or, you know, a significant character in the thing, he got everyone who was alive came back for the return. Michael Ontkean, who played Harry Truman, the sheriff in the original series, had retired, didn't want to act anymore, didn't want to do it. So he called up Robert Forster and got him to be Harry's brother.
Oh, that's cool.
Playing the sheriff. So he finally got to be the sheriff. But
I like stories where Robert Forster gets work.
Imagine if he had gotten Twin Peaks in 1990 and had been on a network show for a couple of years.
I still think he'd been broke. It's just one of those things where...
Yeah, he might, maybe. But I think if he'd been in a better place, you know, right before Jackie Brown than he was.
I really love Jackie Brown, and I feel like he... Well, I think he always would have taken Jackie Brown. But maybe he.
But I mean, he didn't. I don't think he had an agent. I don't think he had.
Well, you know, he did. I think what happened was, if I'm not mistaken, he was borrowing money from his agent at like, you know, a Waffle House somewhere, and Tarantino was in there.
Yeah. Well, he would see him. Yeah, he would see him at a certain Waffle House or sandwich place or something.
Yeah.
And he was gonna maybe use him for something. In Pulp Fiction, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe Reservoir
Dogs. He was probably going to be the wolf in Pulp Fiction.
Okay, so that was it. He was going to be the wolf. And it didn't work out. And he said, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, we're going to do something. So when he hands him the Jackie Brown script, and was it 96 or something, I think?
Yeah.
And, well, let me know what you think. And then they meet up the next day or whenever it is. And Forrester goes, yeah, it's great. It's really great. I mean, I don't know who you want me to be. I don't know who you look. What character are you talking about? And he said, well, Max Cherry, the lead guy. And Forrester goes, oh, Quentin, they're never going to let you cast me in this. Yeah. And Quentin goes, Robert, they're going to let me do whatever I want. And he fucking did it. He cast him in it, and he never stopped working the rest of his life. It's one of the greatest, one of the greatest comeback stories ever. And he was a beautiful guy.
Yeah, really
sweet man. I would see him occasionally, and he was just inquisitive and enthusiastic and just great. So when Twin Peaks came back, which I'm sure you didn't, I'm guessing you didn't see, because there's a lot of Twin Peaks.
I didn't follow the show beginning, so you know it was. Yeah. I also didn't watch the Frasier reboot.
Because they're exactly the same.
Yeah, they're exactly the same.
It's 25 years later, and you know the finale, and spoilers ahead. If you don't know this, turn the show off. The original series
of Twin Peaks recommended for everyone.
The original series of Twin Peaks ends. There's a lot of mythology in it, and the White Lodge and the Black Lodge, and Bob is evil and he's in the Black Lodge, and they come into this world and so on and so forth. Takes over a body kind of. At the end of the series, and they didn't know for sure if it was going to come back or not, but pretty sure it wasn't. Cooper, the hero, comes out of the Black Lodge. He's wounded. They take him back to the hotel, and he gets up from the hotel bed, and they say, well, listen, why don't you, we'll check you out. We can go up to the doctors if you want and check you out at the hospital. And he goes into the bathroom. This is network television. And he smashes his forehead into the mirror. And when he does it, in the mirror is a reflection of this entity called Bob, this scary-looking dude called Bob. And you realize Bob made it out of the Black Lodge, and Cooper is stuck in this ethereal place now. And blood's coming down his forehead, and he just starts saying, how's Annie? How's Annie? Because, you know, he was worried about this other character in the show, and he was making fun of Cooper even asking about it. And that's how the show ends. That's it. So when the new show comes back, for 25 years, this evil entity, going by Mr. C or Cooper, Kyle MacLachlan, has been, you know, cutting a path of destruction and evil, you know, through the country, drugs and so forth. I mean, just pure evil, this thing. Cooper is stuck in the lodge, Kyle MacLachlan. He gets out of the lodge. It's a long story. But there's a tulpa that's been made in the early 90s that looks like Cooper that has to come into the world to kind of replace him. And it's a guy called Dougie Jones. Like, there's no record of him prior. So MacLachlan's playing three characters in this thing. And so when he comes out of the lodge, he's Cooper, but he's not fully Cooper. So he's kind of, it's almost like Peter Sellers in Being There. You know, people will talk to him and say, Dougie, you know, did you, you know, he's going to point to himself and say, Dougie Jones, you know, like just like a child almost. So it's bizarre. It's completely bonkers. But at the same time, the FBI case, the Laura Palmer murder, all these things are starting to converge from 25 years prior. And at the end of the original series, when Cooper's in the lodge before the very, very end, he sees Laura Palmer again, and she says, I'll see you again in 25 years. Hmm. And they did it. They actually did it in this show. It's complicated. It's to explain how it all kind of lays out by the end, but it's 25 years later. And you must remember the dwarf, the little guy called Michael J. Anderson. He was called the Man from Another Place.
I remember the log lady. I mean, that stuff just, you know, you couldn't avoid those kind of references.
Yeah. And so in the original show, in that same scene, he says to Cooper, you know, they're talking backwards. They recorded the dialogue backwards and then ran it forward. So it's completely bizarre. And he says, the next time you see me, I won't look like this. And sure enough, in the new show, there's this entity called the, you know, I am the evolution of the arm. It's like a little tree with a brain on the top. We made a little push puppet of it. Biff, bang, pow.
Yes.
So these little things that they couldn't have ever thought they were going to get back to, this miraculous thing that happened. And it's like an 18-hour movie. And again, he, for what he did with the original, the dream sequence on network, you know, back in 90 and things like that, you know, are still held up as some of the greatest moments of network television. Well, when this one happened, he kind of went, okay, now watch what I do when I'm kind of off the chain, like, you know, like violence and, you know, pushing it further. And there's a couple of many, many moments, but the one episode in particular that is just Eraserhead-ish insanity, that it's just, it's extraordinary. I mean, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And it's brilliant. And it's just, it's been a treat to watch it again and still find little moments of, and there's a lot of horror, a lot of darkness in it that for 25 years, this town has been getting darker and darker and more infected with drugs and violence and murder. And, you know, you can feel it in every corner. And some of the characters have moved on and they've turned out okay. The Audrey character, which was a big character in the original show, as you know, really important character, absolute tragedy what this character goes through in the new series. So it's kind of all over the map, but it's incredibly, incredibly bold, I'd say filmmaking, because that's what it feels like. But also there's one other film he did before that, because I was really ended up being the, you know, a couple of acting things, and that was kind of it. And the Beatles 64 documentary he's in. But he made another film with Laura Dern called Inland Empire.
Yeah, I just found that out.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Sometimes the concept at the center of these things is more interesting than the finished, you know, front to back of it, I feel. And some concepts, you know, that he's got are really fascinating. Don't always hook me till the end, but Inland Empire is an interesting thing too. But I just thought we should, you know, take a moment. He's not totally in our wheelhouse and the stuff we talk about, but
oh no, but this is again on our block.
Yeah, I think so. And he, for guys like us that we're constantly trying to get turned on by new stuff and more stuff and learn, it's a big name for me. He's a big.
No, you know, I remember when I heard about this, I was like, I'm going to hear from Jason because this is personal.
And, well,
I didn't begrudge that. I just knew it was coming.
The fact that and this is it's kind of dumb. I put it on something on Facebook. It was even dumb to say it, but it's so silly because it's infinitesimal, but. The fact that this show came back, this thing that meant so much to me when it was on,
yeah,
it really ticked so many boxes of what I loved already, you know, strangeness and horror and mystery and beautiful women and strange music and so on. We're talking about Frasier. Frasier season 3 of the 72 seasons that show has fucking been on.
Yeah.
The fact that it came back was bizarre enough that we got 18 hours directed by Lynch. He directed every second of that thing and co-written by the two of them, by he and Mark Frost. And they, you know, by hook or by crook, I mean, he had a lot of battles with the network, Showtime. And why do we got to hurry up? What do you mean? What's this cutting down? What the hell's wrong with everybody? Why can't we just finish a goddamn scene? You know, there's these clips you can find where he's just kind of had it. But by God, they did it. And it was a sensation. And again, people couldn't shut up about it week in and week out and the theories and where it was going and everything else. But we had already had a relationship, Biff Bang Pow, with Showtime. And so when I first read that it was coming back, I was just probably insufferable with our people at Showtime and said, whatever happens, if this, you know, I know it's been delayed, but you please don't talk to anybody but us. We've got to do something for Twin Peaks. And I think they betrayed me in a way, because the three and three quarter 4-inch scale went to I want to say Super 7. They made a set of
it was Funko at the time, I think.
Funko, three figures, and then Laura.
It was the reaction. It wasn't Laura, just a
regrettable
idea.
Yeah. And I've got them. I think they're lovely. They're great. Oh my God, I've got an action figure of Cooper. You got to be kidding me. So that category was gone. But we got some other categories, like you know tins, like lunchboxes, you know, journals, mini journals,
bobbleheads,
you know, put the push puppet of the evolution of the arm, things like that. And so it all culminates at Comic-Con 2017. Which is a smack dab, like in the middle of the series running, you know, we get these VIP, you know, upfront passes for Hall H, the entire cast, Lynch, a message from Lynch that only played at Comic-Con. And then the whole cast came over to the Entertainment Earth booth for an event. I mean, the whole thing was just another one of those kind of pinch me moments for me of like Doctor Who and Flash Gordon and, you know, these things that I, you know,
you've run the bases of some fantasy, you know.
Yeah, total fantasy, like.
I mean, Doctor Who, Twin Peaks. Yeah.
You go back and tell that guy in 1990, like, one day you're going to make some stuff and it's going to have. And I'm very, very proud of it. And I was very lucky to meet Lynch briefly.
Yeah.
At that Amoeba thing. And, you know, got a couple things signed, but gave him a Cooper bobblehead. He could have tossed it over his shoulder for all I know. It doesn't matter, but just I had to present him with it.
Who is this guy?
Yeah. Never heard of this. But he kind of went, oh, this is great. This is great. You know, he was really just as he kind of is.
Yeah. And, colloquial. Like, or was, convivial. You know, sorry.
It was just this incredible moment in 2017 where everything kind of was about Twin Peaks. And I'm very, very proud. And, so, yeah, and like you, you know, we have encyclopedic memories and knowledge of things. And, you know, these things take me back to places and times and who I was with and what I was doing. And
absolutely. Yeah,
it gets emotional. It gets really emotional. It's just thinking about this thing that was a constant in my life and he's gone. He'll always be there, but it's just it's kind of a commentary on your own mortality, I think, too, is part of it.
You get sentimental in these autumn years, sir.
Yeah. I think I was kind of born sentimental, but man, it's
been I feel the same.
Been a stickness since. Yeah. So I appreciate you.
Oh no, of course, of course, and you know. Should Sam Sherman die, we're going to do this again.
Of the Sherman Brothers?
No, of Independent International.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're going to go, I haven't seen that.
Happily, but I'll do the homework. I'm willing to put in the time.
I will send you a box set, although I don't want Sam Sherman to die, so maybe I won't do that tomorrow. But yeah, no, it's great. It's great to talk to you. And we need to do our best of 2024.
We absolutely do. I know people are clamoring for it.
Clamoring. Yeah, it's been crazy.
We will do that. And Happy New Year to everyone.
Shop in public. You know, the teenage girls just chase me.
Paparazzi.
Yeah. You know.
Paparazzi everywhere. Yeah. Happy New Year to you. It's a little delayed. I think I did say Happy New Year at the New Year, but I'm saying it again.
Oh, yeah. We texted, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I actually don't remember because I fell asleep at 10 o'clock. I've been working around the clock since October. And that's one of the reasons that we haven't been able to get together. So, yeah, my New Year's was sad.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Well, I hope.
No, I just mean, like in terms of, I just went to bed.
Yeah, I went to a party.
Yeah.
And
oh, now, that's the opposite of what I did.
It was a freak off party.
Oh.
But you know,
got some baby oil to take home.
It was a party. It wasn't one of the originals. Don't get me wrong. This was like seven people, fully clothed.
Oh.
No baby oil, but we called it a freak off party.
Oh.
Okay. In honor of Puffy.
That sounds sarcastic.
But it was nice. It was nice to see some people when it was over at Matt Weinholz and.
Oh, cool.
Talking, you know, comics and toys and horror and stuff and that kind of stuff. So it was nice, but it doesn't really. New Year's doesn't really. Do me
no,
like it used to.
I don't really care. Usually on New Year's I tend to watch a science fiction film, be it, you know, Omega Man or Planet of the Apes or The Thing. It's always a real positive look into the future. But
yeah, I was gonna say
but I just this year I think I passed out at 10, woke up, had a glass of champagne and went right to bed.
Well, you at least had a little bit of champas.
The bubbly, lovely,
yeah. Moments.
Yeah, it was fine. But you know, again, like I'm not a big New Year's guy, anyways.
No, it's just kind of unless you're in an event, it just doesn't. I don't. It makes me sad more than anything. Now, I don't want to see times. I don't care. I just don't. I don't. What year is it? I don't know.
We're in the future.
Yeah, it doesn't mean anything to me anymore. It's all just kind of one big, horrible ride I can't get off.
Yeah, you know? I was trying to think. I think it was the Mark Wahlberg Planet of the Apes is set in 2029.
Is it really? The beginning? When he's in space?
Yeah, really? So that's, you know, like, wow, we aren't there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I revisited that. I want to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's.
I think somebody I was watching
makeup
some
is cool.
Essay makeup about it, and you know what? They nailed it. The ape actors are acting like apes.
They are,
and it isn't that is discordant with the original films that they were
that's
not.
That's right. That's right.
And I've never thought of that, and it blew my mind at 1 a.m.
They spent months working with animal people.
Yeah, but it's not what,
how to, and that's not the point of,
yeah.
They should have been walking around like, you know,
they should have been following British
businessmen.
People around.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yes. I never thought
understood
of it.
That.
Yeah,
and I never quite got that. But the makeup is great. I got to say.
Well, the makeup is great. It's not. It's not its fault. It's
and the best, probably the best story that ever came out of it was a recent one I heard Paul Giamatti on his podcast or something when it somehow came up. I think he had Paul Rudd on or something, and he said, I did Planet of the Apes, you know, and somebody asked a question, and he said, you know, he goes, I love those movies. I just loved those movies growing up, and I loved them, and so. His team or his agent or whoever said, you know, when he was circling it, said, you want to do this? You want to be in ape makeup in a movie? And like, no one's really going to know it's you. And he goes, if you tell them I don't want to make this movie, I will fire all of you. Fire all of you and get a new team. Like, he's that much of a nerd that he was like, I don't care. Just if you turn this down, I will fire everyone. I want to be an ape. And he loved it. He had a great time. And, Rick Baker, I think, did the makeup. And, you know, but yeah, it's a
misfortune. I wanted to talk about a particular Twin Peaks actor that I saw in a terrible movie recently. And I've met this man, Ray Wise, who plays, I think, Laura Palmer's father.
Ray Wise, yeah. He was in
RoboCop. And he was also Swamp Thing. He was the original.
Swamp Thing?
And he's gotten around. I think he's in RoboCop.
RoboCop, yeah, for sure.
I met him through happenstance. I was actually getting John Saxon's autograph.
Okay.
At a convention, and he was next to him, and I couldn't believe there was no line for John Saxon, and I also couldn't believe there was no line for Ray Wise, because like he's such a, and I realized like, hey, I'm in the character actor aisle, you know, and I was watching a film with Ray Wise recently, I think it was one of those. Remember, like in the late 80s, for like a year, we got nothing but Alien ripoffs underwater. So you got
Deep Star Six and Leviathan.
And then like Gods of Atlantis or something, Gods of the Deep. Okay. And then there was one I'd never heard of called The Rift, which is another, it's like Leviathan 2, if you know.
Okay.
But Ray Wise is in it with like, I think Jack Scalia and Arlie Ermey. And through the entire film, Ray Wise is like phoning in his performance.
Oh, is he?
And I'm like, this is really disappointing because that guy is usually the most interesting guy on the screen.
It could be. And maybe he was going, I'm in the ripoff of the ripoff.
Well, here's the thing. Midway through the film, and I hope I'm not spoiling The Rift for anyone. He's the heel. And he does. And he turns into Ray Wise, who is very good at like not camping it up.
Listen, he's got moments in the original Twin Peaks, the original series, and he's briefly in The Return, where he may not be your cup of tea, but when you see him in that show start to go nuts, and he does get nuts in the show because he lost his daughter, he was Laura's father.
Yeah.
And we start to, you know, we find more things out and we find the ultimate thing out. We start to get, you know, hints and so on. He really has to go bonkers. And certainly in his final episode, too. And it's I hate to use the term, but if you want to say tour de force, it's like he will always be identified with that character, you know, the rest of his life. I think he's consistently worked. But he was incredible, going to weird, incredible places in that show, and kind of fearless. He did it. I saw a thing with him a couple years ago, a horror film. I want to say it's called U-Turn. And there's a couple of films called U-Turn, or
yeah,
maybe not U-Turn. I mean, but it's him, the wife, and the two kids in a car are trying to get somewhere, and they kind of take a wrong turn, or they almost hit a woman or see an accident or something. And it becomes almost like an episode of Twilight Zone, like a 90-minute, like, where are they? What are they doing? Where are they going? It was kind of a little gem, you know, a little kind of hidden gem. And it was nice to see him in something. I think it's maybe 10 years old or so. But yeah, I met him once briefly at one of those shows.
Yeah. He just seemed like a real, down to earth guy.
Yeah.
And it was just strange to see him in this film being so
low-key.
And then I found out, oh, okay, he was, you know, playing a different character.
Nice.
But he's a convincing baddie, that's for sure.
He is. And he's a handsome fella, but he's got that sinister kind of look to him, too. He's got those eyes, you know? Almost like Richard Lynch's better-looking younger brother, kind of.
I knew we were going to bring up Richard Lynch somehow.
Well, you mentioned him today.
Well, mentioned it because, you know, we were talking, and this is shedding the curtain on the show, about how I wasn't all that, you know, up-to-date on David Lynch films. And then later on, I sent you a text saying, oh, crap, I've been watching Richard Lynch films, knowing you'd get that reference.
And oddly enough, I had just told my Richard Lynch story to someone that morning. So that's pretty cosmic that you would.
That is. That means we're, Doc Savage had his, his hive mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a hive mind.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, he gets brought up almost as much as Marjo and, what's his name? Come on.
Oh, isn't Clint Howard?
No. Vincent D'Onofrio. No. Vincent Carcotti. No. You know the guy. Victor Buono. Victor Buono.
Oh, Victor Buono. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was 23 when he died.
Yeah, I actually, I see Victor Buono every day because when we moved our offices, which is what has been embroiling my life in the last few months, I found a poster for the Matt Helm movie, The Silencers.
Oh, okay.
And it's pretty phallic. Like, it is Dean Martin riding a giant gun with girls lifting it up.
And I've seen that poster.
A friend of mine gave it to me. It was long since passed. And I realized it's kind of a cool-ass poster that, like, my wife doesn't love. But I named my son Dean after Dean Martin. So I put it on the wall in my new office, and I get to see Victor Bono in yellow face.
There's worse on my wall
every day
than Victor Bono in yellow face.
Oh, he is the most unconvincing Asian ever.
Yeah, he was. God, it's funny you mentioned Matt Helm. I was watching Zulu the other night. Michael Caine, 1963, British war picture. And one of the guys, now I can't think of his name, but he's a British actor. He kind of started in comedy on stage a little bit, made his way into movie, like TV, like he'd show up in The Avengers and shows like that in the 60s, and then made his way into film. And as I'm looking it up, and I'm looking up his name, like, oh, yeah, I know him from some. And he showed up, he eventually moved to Hollywood in the 80s. And was steady on shows like Heart to Heart and things like that. Hmm. And lo and behold, he was a character on Twin Peaks in season 2. Huh. But he was also in, what's the Matt Helm with Sharon Tate?
Oh, that's the last one. I always get the names mixed up.
It's not Murderer's Row.
Murderer's Row. There's the Silencers, the Ambushers. Murderer's Row
and that one. Yeah, one. He's in that movie. He's in that Matt Helm movie.
Oh, okay. So that's weird. Stanley Baker?
No, Stanley Baker is the lead in Zulu, and he co-wrote the screenplay, I think. It's the guy who is kind of a shit, and he won't fight initially. He's complaining about his shoulder, but then eventually kind of comes around and, you know, kind of saves the day, kind of one of the heroes. But I cannot think of his name. But It's weird that you mentioned Matt Helm, and he's in that other Matt Helm that we can't think of. Yeah. It's featured in Once Upon a Time. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but did we study the poster? Okay, before we go, I'll just look it up because it's...
Yeah, Murderer's Row, Silencers...
The Wrecking Crew.
The Wrecking Crew, of course.
Which is my least favorite Matt Helm movie because it doesn't have James Gregory as McDonald in it.
I've been saying this to anyone who'd listened for years, that's what's missing in that Matt Helm film.
Oh, it's also done. like I remember my mom saying, oh yeah, I remember we went out to see the Wrecking Crew, and at one point Matt Helm jumps into a, like, you can see the trampoline.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh,
talk about I love Dean Martin, don't get me wrong, but talk about phoning it in.
Yeah.
I mean, those are one take wonders. Every scene in those movies is like, do we have to do another one? I don't think. You know,
also, I just want to point out its glaring proximity to 9 months before I was born is upsetting me.
the Wrecking Crew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It came out, I think.
We don't need to talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to know the math.
We don't need
that
to.
One. We don't need I to just look remember up my parents talking about it was a date night and.
Yeah, we don't need to look up the Playboy Playmate of the month you were born. We don't really need to do that right now.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the month I was born. Well, I mean,
probably for the best.
I didn't know her.
But thank you again. I'm glad we got to talk about this. And next one we'll do our top of the year, toppermost of 24, and sooner than later.
Absolutely, I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay. Now,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And my best to the family for the new year and everything. And we'll talk very soon. Thanks, everyone.
Absolutely.
For listening.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And drop us topic suggestions at our Facebook group.
Please do.
All right. Cheers, man.